good morning, everybody. My name is Brian Brocco. I'm a Seattle area, California, Washington attorney. A little bit of background in corporate law, contracts, and mortgage compliance. And I appreciate you joining me today for NCAA and name, image, likeness, call it updates, and anarchy in America. And that's really how it is. It's wild out there if you've been paying attention to see how this thing is developing. We're only about 15 months into name, image, likeness, and it is changing rapidly. Outside of work, I've coached youth and high school football, the wide receivers and defensive backs, all the divas. I've taught at high school coaching clinics on coaching communication and conflict management. My old divorce law days helps out with that. I've written a few short student-athlete development books, and I love to teach sports law, continuing legal education classes. I don't have time to be out on the field coaching anymore, so this is kind of how I get my my sports fix. I've taught classes on NFL agency, NCAA recruiting, and next year I'll be doing diving into college coaching contracts with all the changes going on. It should be interesting to see how the coaches and the schools handle that. Today, for updates in anarchy in America, we're going to talk about name, image, likeness, and the changes that have taken place since the interim policy went into place July of 2021. We'll talk about booster regulations and the rise of the collective. They're kind of the dark star at this point. We'll see how that goes. And then we'll dive into transfer portal protections, some additional things that the NCAA put in place to protect the student athletes. And again, there's unintended consequences. It'll be good for the student athletes that have strong cases, and we can pretty much guarantee there will be student athletes that take advantage of it. So who this course is for, you don't have to be a sports law attorney. There's a lot of crossover here with college athletes. Let's say you're a divorce attorney and you work with families that have kids going off to college and they're going on scholarship to play soccer. They will have questions on name, image, likeness to make sure their kid doesn't lose their scholarship, gets booted from school, and ends up on ESPN for all the wrong reasons. Let's say you work with marketing companies. Marketing firms are going to be involved with this. They want to get into the name, image, likeness game of student athletes, so they'll have questions. And then also, if you just work with local companies, they might want to get involved with social media blasts and endorsements from student athletes. You know, it could be the local barbershop, tattoo parlor, coffee shop. If you represent those businesses near campus, they may want to get involved, so they'll have questions for you. Three keys for today. This is so important. I mean, we could do updates on this every week, literally. This is not evergreen material. That there will be changes, and there will be rapid changes. Second, keep in mind the NCAA has punted on name, image, likeness. They kicked it over to the states. So whatever states you live in, whatever schools you're around, name, image, likeness, this is very much a school-by-school and state-by-state issue. No state is going to be the same. North Carolina is not going to be the same as California. California is not going to be the same as Wyoming. Wyoming is not going to be the same as Florida. So you really got to pay attention to the updates from the NCAA, your state legislature, and then also the schools that you're kind of around on a daily basis. Third, this one's critical too. The NCAA is actively looking for violators because this is such a brand new area. Kind of like if you're a litigator, the way that you set those boundaries is with case law. With the NCAA, the way that you set those boundaries is with consent orders and enforcement actions. So they are actively looking for bad actors right now. You don't want to be the first one over the fence, and you definitely don't want to be the last one over the fence, but you got to make sure that we are doing things correctly because the NCAA is looking to set those boundaries. They are looking for attorneys or agents or coaches or boosters or student athletes or schools. If they're doing things the wrong way, they're looking for that so they can set the boundaries on how to handle name, image, likeness. So let's get going. You know, there's no real nail experts right now because it's so new. It's only been out for about 15 months. We're all doing the best we can, but just kind of keep in mind, this is going to be a rapidly changing field. So what we're doing today, we'll do a quick introduction, then we'll dive into nil. Then we'll look at boosters and collectives, which is a brand new term in sports law. And then we'll look at the new changes for the transfer portal, and then we'll wrap up with some tips. Working definitions for today. These are not perfect or complete definitions, but just for today so we're on the same page. A prospective student athlete, a PSA, that's a high school athlete. A student athlete is a college athlete. So PSA versus SA. Boosters and collectives. A booster is somebody who financially supports an athletic program, not necessarily the school, but they just love Bama football. A collective, that's going to be a group of supporters who will pool funds, and then they will put together name, image, likeness deals for athletes. They might put together endorsement deals themselves, or they might facilitate it with that pool of funds, and they'll go out there and find, endorsement deals for the athletes. So name, image, likeness, what does that mean? We all kind of know name. Name would be a Reggie Bush signed football. Image, that would be Bryce Young, the Bama quarterback right now. He's making millions of dollars in endorsements, and you'll see him Saturday morning on the Heisman House commercial. So that's an image. It could be a video, could be a photograph. Bryce Young, 3 years ago, as a college athlete, he would have lost a scholarship and been on ESPN for all the wrong reasons, but with name, image, likeness, he's playing QB at Bama, and he's on the Heisman House commercial and making a ton of cash. Likeness. Likeness is not a personality or brand or goodwill. Likeness is a graphic representation of an athlete's image. So think of the Jerry West NBA graphic representation. You've all seen that. That is likeness. It's a graphic representation of him. Or maybe one that's a little more current would be Michael Jordan on the Nike, the jumping man. We all know that's Michael Jordan. That would be what we call a likeness. Then also the transfer portal, that is the window that is set for student athletes to announce that they want to transfer schools. So let's jump into the introduction. Page four, if you know Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know this quote, wow, does he really live here? I thought he just flew in for the games. And that's so true at the high school level now. Name, image, likeness is now impacting high school selection. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So page five, here's the history of college sports endorsements and pay-for-play. We're kind of looking at history repeating itself. So 1904, who was there? So we had James Hogan, famous footballer at Yale, and he signed an endorsement deal with J.T. Wilcox cigarettes. Probably not going to see that anymore, but he's sparking a few at halftime and getting his name out there, getting a nickel a pack maybe. 1939, University of Pittsburgh players went on strike for higher pay. You wouldn't see that today. Yeah, maybe at University of Miami, but you wouldn't see that today at the NCAA level. 1948, the college crew got tired of this stuff, and they said, all right, no more payments or endorsements, nothing under the table. It's getting out of hand. And that was called the Sanity Code, and they said you can get money for scholarship, books, tuition, some mashed potatoes at night, and some macaroni and cheese, and that's about it. It was that way for a long time, for decades and decades. 2019, California finally stepped in with SB 206, and they put together the first name, image, likeness bill for college athletes, and it was going to go into effect in 2023. So a little bit of breathing room. California is the bluest of states. What did Florida do? Florida is one of the reddest states. And Florida said, you know what? We're going to go one better. We dislike the NCAA more than you, California. So Florida said, we're going to put in our state NIL bill effective 7/21. So they jumped in, and they jumped in quick. And that forced the NCAA to take action. So the NCAA put together the interim NIL policy effective 7/21. And they put out some additional guidance over the months. We had guidance in May of 2022. And they put out guidance in July of 22 to clarify the guidance from 5/22, which was set to clarify guidance from 7/21. And on it goes. Every time you put out a new set of rules, there's questions that come up. So it requires new guidance. 2023, I'm guessing this is going to be the year of enforcement actions because this is so new and the NCAA has to set those guidelines. They're going to be looking at collectives. They're going to be looking at nil deals. They're going to be looking at how the transfer portal is utilized. And off we go. Stats, you may not like that student athletes are going to get paid for endorsement deals, but this is a ton of cash for the NCAA. March Madness, $8.8 billion for the NCAA. Playoffs for football, $7.3 billion. The average fair market value for a men's hoops player is roughly $265 a year, which sounds pretty sweet. If you're getting a scholarship and all in, $150K a year, But if you're getting $150K for your condo and the fair market value on your condo is $265, you're probably going to fire that real estate agent. And then the NCAA student athlete salary is $0, and they don't have time to play anything or do anything outside of practicing and going to class. So nil deals is going to be kind of a nice way for them to pick up some money along the way. Look at the schedule on page 7. You got to be a full-time student, roughly 12 to 15 hours a week during season, 30 hours of study hall, that's 2 hours per class per week, and then athletics, you're kind of capped at 20 hours, that's practice and games, does not include flight time. So if you got a flight from Miami up to LA, that 6-hour flight does not count against a cap. Chances are the kids are not studying on the plane. They're probably playing video games, watching Netflix. That's a 65-hour work week. So you can't go out and get a part-time job to send money home to your family. It's great that you're on scholarship, but if you got $5 in your pocket and mom and dad back home, they have no money in the fridge, not a good deal. So nil is going to allow kids to send some cash back home. Here is the pool of athletes. You got 182,000 athletes on Division I on page 8, and that is a big pool, roughly 500,000 student athletes nationwide across all three divisions. Kind of think back to the gold rush. Did you want to be a gold miner? Yeah, you can make some money. But really, the people who made money were selling shovels and selling Levi's, and that's kind of where all these ancillary services come in. The branding reps, the marketing company, the agents, the sports attorneys. Everyone's kind of diving in because that's a huge pool of people to make money. And this is, it's a fun industry, right? You want to work on contracts for a student athlete. You don't want to work on contracts for a dry clean. So it's a little bit more fun on this side of the aisle. So it's going to bring in some kind of shady characters, and we'll see how that develops. So page 9, we're jumping into name, image, likeness. If you guys saw the game this last weekend with Alabama and Texas A&M, Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher go back a long ways. They kind of grew up together, and they coached together at Bama, and they're sniping. I mean, this is all about recruiting at this point with name, image, likeness, and it's a war. So Nick Saban says, we were second in recruiting last year. A&M was first, and A&M bought every single player on their team, made a deal for name, image, likeness. That is not even just throwing a shot across the bow. That's just sideswiping his old assistant coach. And Jimbo Fisher says it's despicable that we have to defend the people of this organization. We got 17-year-old kids and their families. Some people, Saban, think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. Kind of taking a shot back and forth. And this is how it is. I mean, this is very much a different landscape for recruiting with the transfer portal and name, image, likeness. And coaches are going to be going after each other, and there's not enough hours in the day to recruit as it is. And now with name, image, likeness, with the transfer portal, it's going to be an incredibly difficult job for these college coaches. So here we go on page 10. The interim policy was effective for the NCAA on 7/21. It's a uniform policy across all three divisions, and it suspended the NCAA rules on nil, and it applies to all sports, and the NCAA has punted. They will not be coming back in here after the year they've had with some of the developments with Alston and educational benefits and that kind of thing. That Supreme Court case has said universities, you can't cap those educational benefits for the athletes. So the NCAA is just, they're out. They punted. They're out the door. And so they said back in July of 2021, the interim policy will be in effect until federal legislation kicks in nationwide or new NCAA rules adopted. Don't hold your breath. And this was the important part. They said the schools and conferences can adopt whatever rules they want. So the NCAA said, you broke it. You bought it, baby. And these are sort of the requirements on page 11 for what the interim policy says. NCAA said student athletes can pursue nil deals consistent with state law and school policies. Student athletes in states with no nil policy can still pursue nil without violating NCAA rules. So whatever state you're in, if your state has a nil rule, if they don't, you can still pursue endorsement deals without losing your scholarship and getting in trouble with the NCAA. Student athletes can have a professional service provider for endorsement deals. That means agents, tax advisors, which is going to be key, and attorneys as well. So we can jump in there and help out, not a problem on nil deals, but they do make an exception. They still have the rule where you cannot be using agents, to look at pro contracts. If you want to keep your eligibility, you can have an agent to go get you an endorsement deal and look over those contracts. But if you're athlete with eligibility remaining and you have a verbal to sign an agent for a pro contract down the road, you will lose your eligibility at that point. Then again, the student athlete must report the deals consistent with school, conference, and state law. And again, this is school by school, state by state. Don't think because you've read the rules from one school or one state that that's going to apply to everybody else. A little bit of Q&A, start on page 12. What is name, image, likeness? We talked about that. It's a signed football. It's a commercial, it's a photograph, or it's a graphic representation. What is NIL? That's using the student athlete's NIL for commercial or promotional activity. Pretty obvious, but just if you're new to copyrights and intellectual property, it's good to know that. What is the NIL impact on student athletes and high school athletes, PSAs? Same rules. PSA or SAs doesn't matter. The NCAA says you can be pursuing NIL deals consistent with state law. Some states allow high school athletes to go after NIL deals, and some do not, which means we're going to have, after the pandemic, you got a lot of parents out there who are able to work remote, and if they got a kid who can make $100K a year in name, image, likeness, they might pack up their bags and move to a state that's more friendly for high school athletes and NIL deals. But you cannot be using it for recruiting inducements or pay-for-play, and again, consult state law. What you need to make sure for NIL deals is that there is a quid pro quo between the cash and the service. If a car dealership says we're going to pay you $2,000 to come down, give a speech, sign some autographs, you got to show up. There's got to be some services for that money. It's got to be based on fair market value. Nobody knows what that means. It's a gray area. The fair market value for one athlete might be $2,000 for a speech, and for another, it might be $200 depending on their celebrity. Fair market value is going to be a gray area. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And again, I'll probably say this 20 times today, but this is really where the NCAA is focusing, is you cannot be using NIL deals as a recruiting inducement or a transfer inducement, and it cannot be a pay-for-play. You cannot tell an athlete, I'm going to give you $100 for every home run that you hit. Cannot be based on pay-for-play. Can, on page 13, can a PSA/SA sign with a booster? Yes. Got to meet state law and school policy. Can it be an inducement or PFP? Sound familiar? Can international student athletes sign a NIL deal? Yes, they can, but visas, this is above my pay grade, but when it comes to international student athletes, even those from Canada, Canada counts as international, but you got to see your designated school officer regarding immigration status and visa issues and tax issues. If you are on a student visa and Nike offers you $1 million to do a commercial, can you be on a student visa and get paid $1 million? Probably not. Again, I'm not immigration attorney, so I'll defer, and I've got an email there. But keep track of this when it's a very fluid situation. It's not fair to the international students, and they might change it. Who the hell knows? It might have changed 5 minutes ago. It might change 2 months from now. But just kind of keep in mind, this is a very fluid issue and it will change. So the international student athletes can lose their visa possibly if they sign that deal, but they might be able to get these deals done in their home country. So at the U.S., international student, you might get the boot, but you might be able to do a deal with back in your home territory. So moving on, page 14, pretty simple process to get the NIL deals done. An endorsement opportunity shows up for a student athlete, the family, and the agent. You got to evaluate it for pay for play or inducements, fair market value. Got to make sure it's consistent with school regulations and state law. You got to report that endorsement deal consistent with state law and school policy. But again, school by school, state by state. Some schools require you to notify them in advance so they can look over the contract. Some schools do not want to have any deals that conflict with their school sponsorships. And there might be some value issues as well. Some schools say you cannot be signing deals with a cannabis shop, cannot be involved in alcohol, tobacco, gambling, guns, unsafe unicycles, and dangerous roller coasters. Who knows what's out there? But they just want to make sure that they can look over these deals. But again, school by school, state by state. So if he passes all that stuff, then you go and you cash that check and do it again. But that's it. That's the whole process right there. So page 15, the NCAA will not be monitoring for endorsement deals with state law. And the NCAA said, go talk to your colleges as a resource for state law, and it can get even more complicated. You got a kid growing up, going to high school in state A, and that kid is getting recruited into state B. Now you got a couple of states to look at as far as what the rules are, and it just gets more and more complicated as we go along with taxes and road games and things like that that are going to come up. There are a lot of unintended, unexpected things that will create complications as we kind of flesh this out. NCAA enforcement, they keep coming back to this every time they send out a notice. They notify everybody, we're looking for improper inducements. Don't be telling kids, come to school here and we're going to get you an endorsement deal. You can't be tampering with transfers, cannot have pay per play. It's got to be based on fair market value, and NCAA will look for agents who are getting involved in verbals with student athletes to be their agent for pro contracts. You can have an agent to pursue endorsement deals because there's contracts and things like that that they got to help out with. You cannot have an agent as a verbal to handle a pro contract 2 years down the road once the college eligibility expires. Because if you have a verbal or a pro contract for 2 years down the road, future, you can still lose your scholarship and end up on ESPN for all the wrong reasons. So agents, yes for endorsement deals, no for pro contracts until that kid decides to go pro. Woo, man, what a mess. We're up on page 16. Just recap what we've had here since 2019. California jumped in. 2019 signed that bill, said we're going to give it some breathing room. We'll kick it off in 2023. Florida said to hell with that. We're kicking it off in July of 2021. That forced the NCAA's hand. And we have the interim NIL policy since July of 2021. And Alabama, hard to believe Alabama, but they signed a state-based nil deal, nil rule, after the NCAA signed their interim policy. And within a year, Alabama looked at their state-based nil rule, and they said, this is too restrictive on recruiting. So within a year, Alabama signs HB 404 for state-based nil, and they repealed it with HB 76 because they said, let's let the schools handle this. Let's not put any restrictions in place that impact recruiting for Alabama and Auburn. So let's kind of summarize this. The NIL policy is a mess for now. I mean, it's good in a way because we're allowing competition between schools and states to see how this works out and what's effective, what's ineffective, what's good for the student athletes, what's not. It's good to have that competition. But again, it's going to be messy. There's going to be a lot of unintended things that come up that create problems for student athletes, families, agents, coaches, schools, and sports law attorneys. So the NCAA, page 17, they said, peace out. We've got state patchwork right now. Some have nil laws. Some do not. Some have amended them. Some have repealed them. Some states allow high school athletes to pursue endorsement deals. Some do not. Take a look at California. The Interscholastic Federation, section 212, and that talks about how high school athletes can take advantage of nil. Yeah, again, if your parents are in a state that don't allow nil for high school athletes and you work remote, why not pack up and just move to a state that allows you to take advantage of those nil rules for high school athletes and collect $100K per year for your kid? Not a bad shop option. Some states, some schools have disclosure rules, some do not, and some states and schools allow a heavy amount of school involvement in structuring these nil deals, and some do not. That's a gray area. That's going to be one to watch. I think North Carolina does allow schools to be pretty closely involved in these nil deals, so that's going to be one to watch. And again, it's just school by school, state by state. Nothing is consistent across the country. Federal proposals, there's been around 7 or 8, maybe it's up to 15 different federal proposals, and they have all stalled out. There's not a huge appetite to jump into this. So for now, we have state patchwork, and that's where we're going to be for a while. So that's NIL. Let's jump into boosters and collectives on page 18, and I love this quote. It's from a former coach, and he says, the coaches are making millions of dollars, and they're coaching players who live below the poverty line. And is that fair? I mean, we've got coaches signing huge contracts and they have buyout provisions and they go from school A to school B and then school B pays the buyout. So it really doesn't impact the coach all that much. And they're out there recruiting kids coming to their school. So now I'm going to be here for 20 years. I'm like Coach K. I'm going to be here for 30 years. Trust me. And then they bail the next week. So it really wasn't fair to the student athletes for years and years to have to put up with that. And there's been some changes for that. The other thing to keep in mind is that some of these kids, yeah, it's pretty cool if you get a scholarship. But if you're living in South Central LA, it's not just, you're not just living in poverty. You might be living in gangland. And, you know, dad's nowhere to be found. Mom strung out on drugs. Two younger brothers are being recruited into a gang. You get a scholarship up to Stanford. That's great. You're up at Stanford in the Bay Area. You're on scholarship. You got your room and board, your tuition paid for, but you're not able to make any money to send back home to help out your two younger brothers and problems at home. It was really incredibly unfair that it was set up that way. But now with endorsement deals, we will have a chance for these student athletes who are economically disadvantaged and coming up from tough environments to make some money and help out the family back home, which is great. And they're also getting some business skills along the way, reading contracts. So let's look at the boosters and collectives. So after the interim policy came out in July of 2021, lots of questions, as there always are with any kind of new area of law. And the NCAA put out nil guidance on third parties in May of 2022. They didn't even call it collectives at that point. They just said third parties. They were just putting their toes into the water. So this was a 10-month update on the nil policy, and the focus was on nil and boosters and the impact on high school athletes, school choice, and student athletes transfers between universities. So they took a very tepid conservative approach, and they said if a third party triggers booster status, then they can't be involved in recruiting or transfer tampering, can't be involved in undue benefits like providing housing for student athletes or pay for play. And it's a real sort of safe way to bring out some guidance on that. They didn't actually call out collectives, even though collectives was in the vocabulary for this area of law, but they just said third parties. So that's kind of what they did. They started to go down the path of, yeah, we got a problem here with the rise of the collectives. We got to figure this one out because they got a ton of cash, pretty smart people, and they're going to figure out ways to get money over to these student athletes. So let's go to the next page on page 20, boosters and third parties. They reiterated again that there's no recruiting conversations with boosters, with PSAs, high school athletes, their family or associates. And that's usually what happens is that the boosters are back channeling. They will go down and they will talk to the barber that handles haircuts for the high school athletes. They will talk to the tattoo parlor, the personal trainer, coffee shop. They will work their way person to person, all these back channels to get to the family and try to build up as much of a smoke screen as they can. But you can't have these direct or indirect conversations with the high school athletes and their families or associates. Nil cannot be guaranteed contingent on initial or continued enrollment. So the booster cannot say, I've got a $10,000 endorsement deal here, but it's only going to go to you if you decide to come to my university that I am supporting. You cannot have that done by boosters. And then also the coaches cannot play matchmaker between the PSA and the boosters. That means the coaches cannot introduce high school athletes and student athletes to the boosters, and the coaches cannot provide boosters lists of who they're recruiting and who they're looking at in the transfer portal, because if the coach sends that to the booster, you can be guaranteed the booster is going to be reaching out indirectly to the family and saying, hey, we got a ton of cash here for you if you play ball with us. And then again, nil, it's got to be based on fair market value, not enrollment-based and not pay for performance-based. And that the NCAA will typically say that in every kind of guidance that comes out, because they want to make sure that it's very clear that, yeah, they've taken a backseat on nil, but they are looking for violations. All right, page 21, some legislative reminders. This one's going to be tricky. They said that athletic departments cannot represent PSAs and SAs for these endorsement deals, but some states, some schools are taking a very active role in getting these nil deal done. Now, any school can be involved in education, and they should be. They should be educating these kids on, you know, brand and goodwill and contracts, making sure they know how to put that money away for paying taxes at the end of the year. But technically, under the NCAA rules, the athletic departments can't represent these kids on endorsement deals, but some schools want to be really close to it. Some pros and cons on that. The closer you are to the deal, the more subject you are to liability, but the less involved you are, the more chance that there's going to be some problems with the NCAA enforcement actions. National letter of intent. That's always on ESPN. The kid sits down at the table with 10 baseball caps, and he picks one of the caps, he or she picks one of the caps, and that's the school that they're going to go to before the high school athlete signs an NLI. Got to make sure that the school only publicly confirms recruitment. The school can't be floating ideas about, hey, we're going to get a pretty sweet endorsement deal for the new class of recruits. You can't be saying that kind of stuff. And this one is key for the schools. They are responsible for any impermissible recruiting by the boosters, and that's where it gets the school's attention. You know, they want the best athletes possible, but they are ultimately responsible for any violations by the boosters, and the schools want to be on TV. They don't want the recruiting cut. They don't want the recruiting trips cut. They want to get to March Madness. They want to get to the bowl games. So they want to make sure that they are keeping the boosters and third parties, AKA collectives, in line. So the NCAA came out with another set of guidance. So they came out with guidance in May of 2022. That raised more questions because they didn't call out collectives. They didn't even name them. So July of 2022, they reiterated a booster. A booster is somebody who promotes a program that's allowed. Boosters are also people who are involved in tampering with recruiting and undue benefits, which is not allowed. Now, if a collective rises to the level of a booster, then they're subject to booster rules and restrictions. And so finally, the NCAA said, okay, here we go. Here we'll talk about collectives. We're tired of getting the hell beat out of us. So they said, if an individual or nil entity, a collective, if their sole or primary purpose is to engage in endorsement activities with student athletes, which is what a collective does, they pool their money and funnel that to kids with endorsement deals. If their primary purpose is to get those endorsement deals for student athletes, that collective is a booster and subject to the restrictions. Second, if a nil entity, a collective, is involved in recruiting activities for nil purposes, which is not allowed, such an individual triggers the booster status. So if they're setting up funds for endorsement deals, that is a collective, and a collective is a booster subject to the restrictions. And if they are involved in the illegal recruiting activities, that also makes them a booster, and they will be subject to those restrictions and getting the school in trouble. So page 23, a little bit of Q&A on collectives. So a collective contacts a high school athlete for recruiting and promises a nil deal after enrollment at the university. Is that allowed? No. That is a recruiting violation, and an endorsement deal cannot be contingent on enrollment. Second, a collective contacts a high school athlete's uncle. So they kind of work in those back channels. That's typically how it goes. It's going to go through five or six people before it gets from the booster to the family. So the collective contacts the PSA's uncle, and they promise a roster spot, and they verbally agree on a nil deal with the uncle, and they promise the uncle a finder's fee if that kid goes to the university and plays ball. Is that allowed? No, because indirect contact with a high school athlete and the family member or associate, like a high school coach, pastor, you know, personal coach, again, barbershop, whatever it is, whoever has influence over that high school athlete, that is going to be a recruiting violation. And again, the nil deal cannot be contingent on enrollment. So page 24, let's talk about the coaches a little bit. Coaches and the boosters, you got that triangle between the coaching staff, the boosters and collectives, and then the PSA and the family. So the coach has a relationship with the booster, which is pretty common. The booster wants the coach to pitch an All-American high school athlete on an endorsement deal. Is that allowed? So the booster contacts the coach and says, we want to get this kid.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is FAR, F-A-R, all lowercase, FAR. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is FAR, F-A-R, all lowercase, FAR. Please take a moment and write this down.
To endorse our products, talk to him or her, get them on our side. Can they do that? No. The coach and the staff can't communicate with the PSA on behalf of the collective booster, so you cannot be playing matchmaker. Is the coach allowed any communication with the collective? Yes, that's fine. The coach can always talk to the collective, and that's going to be kind of a routine process. So the coach is allowed to have communication with the collective, but the coach cannot be the matchmaker or provide any kind of recruiting or transfer portal lists to the collective. The coach can't reach out to the collective and say, we are recruiting this kid. Maybe you can help us out, put some pressure on them, tell them you got a couple of deals lined up, can't be doing that stuff. Can the coach promote current NIL deals with student athletes to a high school athlete on the recruiting trail? So the high school coach, the college coach flies out to talk to a high school, the college coach flies out on a recruiting trip to talk to a high school athlete and his family. Family's asking about current deals with student athletes at the university. Yes, that's fine. If it's factually based, a college coach can talk to the high school athlete and the family about those deals that are set up. What the coach cannot do is promise that same deal to the high school athlete and the family. So at some of these universities, they have collective set up that are funneling, let's say, $50,000 to all of the starting linemen on a college team. So currently, all the starting linemen on a college team are getting $50,000 per year. They go out and do some speeches, sign some autographs, everything's good. You can talk about that when you're recruiting, but you cannot tell the high school athlete and the family, see the guys over there, they're making $50,000 per year, come to my school, and you were guaranteed that same deal. Can't do that. So there's kind of a bright line test there. You can talk about the current deals that you have on campus. You cannot be using that incentive to get them on your campus and saying you're going to get them the same deal. So this one's kind of interesting on page 25. The recruiting conversation, they kind of reiterated again the same stuff, no communication with the high school athlete associates for recruiting purposes or enrollment, blah, blah, blah. No communication with the family on transfer purposes, blah, blah, blah. But this sentence at the bottom caught my attention, and I think this is one where collectives can get tripped up. It's in July 22 for the Q&A, they said that these prohibitions extend to any individual, could be a former or a current student athlete, working on behalf of the collective. So the collectives, you get these 40, 50-year-old dudes who are kind of out of it, and they are employing current student athletes or maybe a famous former student athlete to reach out on their behalf, and you cannot be doing that. The NCAA is doing the best it can to close down all these bad ways of incentivizing kids to go to school or transfer to school and doing all this kind of stuff. So they're saying, look, collectives, if you are employing former student athletes to kind of work on these high school kids, can't be doing that kind of stuff. All right. Page 26, this is what the collectives look like. So again, they pool their money together and they funnel it to the student athletes on these endorsement deals. You can set it up as a nonprofit. 501c3 has got to be based on a charitable purpose, which is perfectly fine. It's kind of these collectives, again, they're usually pretty successful in business. They have a lot of networking opportunities and people to bounce ideas off of, and they're going to come up with very creative ways to funnel cash to the student athletes. And so you'll see some of these collectives are set up as nonprofits. And it could be, it could be a legitimate cause. It could be cancer awareness. It could be the environment. It could be the Boys and Girls Club. Whatever it is, it's got to be a charitable purpose. The student athlete will pick a charity that's important to him or her. Then the collective pays the student athlete as an independent contractor for services to that charity. So that means, doing social media posts, showing up at events, signing autographs, doing that kind of stuff. But the student athlete picks a charity, gets paid by the collective for services to the charity. And then what do you know? Some of the donations, this is going to be one of those things that has to be worked out, but the donations would be tax deductible. So another nice little perk if you set it up as a nonprofit. So, you know, you kind of got to look at it and say, well, are they really setting up this nonprofit collective as a legitimate way to fund a charitable purpose? Or is it a way to funnel money to the kids? Or is it somewhere in between there? I think we all kind of know the answer to that, but that is a legitimate way to set up a collective. So if it's not a nonprofit, it can be a for-profit. Sounds about right. And you can be as creative with those as you want. And you'll see a lot of subscription-based models where, you know, you pay $15 a month and you get to sit in on a video Q&A with the athletes, get some autographs. It could be, you know, sponsorship, go down to the car dealership, sign some autographs, get a couple $1,000, donations, whatever, you name it. If it's for profit, then they can pretty much do what they want to set up these deals, as long as it's, again, not based on a illegal incentive, or it's not based on, you know, something that's not fair market value or pay for play, then that's pretty much game on. So page 27, quick little summary here, a collective as of July 22nd with the guidance, collective, yeah, they closed the door. A collective pretty much is a booster and therefore subject to booster rules and restrictions on recruiting and tampering. And also, I got to make sure that we do have a quid pro quo. That's important. You got to have payments for services. If you get paid $2,000 to deliver a speech, you got to deliver a speech. And don't get it twisted on quid pro quo. You must have a quid pro quo between the payment and the services provided by the student athlete. You cannot have a quid pro quo between payment and enrollment at a specific university. Title IX will be interesting. You got to have equal scholarships for the male and female student athletes. And what is happening is a lot of booster money is getting funneled to individual athletes instead of the school and the whole overall athletic program. And you've got all these non-revenue sports that depend on those funds to keep them afloat, especially if you're swimming. But if you're a booster, why do you want to go put a big billboard out in front of the stadium when you can funnel it to a student athlete that has, you know, 3 million followers on Instagram? And this is becoming an issue. The NCAA is looking at some of these collectives. As one example, I'm not sure what the status of it is now, but at BYU, a collective set up a fund to support the walk-ons for the guys' football team. So for a football team, I think you can have 85 players on scholarship, and then I think it's 25 players as walk-ons. So the walk-ons have to pay their own way. So the collective said, you know what? We're going to set up these endorsements for the walk-on players because they have to pay their own way. So in effect, what they're doing is setting up unofficial scholarships for those 25 walk-on players. That dries up a lot of money that might be available for the non-revenue sports and for Title IX scholarships. So on it goes. That it's going to be, you know, again, it's going to be unintended consequences and a lot of new stuff that comes up that we haven't seen before at the NCAA level. And just got to keep tracking the stuff. You bookmark the NCAA updates. You bookmark your state legislature. You bookmark the AD department at the universities that you're associated with. And that's how you keep track of this stuff. And here we go, August 22, the NCAA reaching out to the member schools, and they wanted to make it known that the enforcement staff is actively investigating potential abuses of endorsement transactions, and their focus is on the actors who pose a threat to the integrity of college sports. So they're not looking at targeting student athletes, but they are looking at those who are around the student athletes putting this stuff together. So that could be coaches, it could be the school itself. That's going to be the boosters, collectives, agents, sports law attorneys, whoever is trying to get their nose in the tent here on this fun field. They're looking at those people and trying to look for violations, because again, you got to set boundaries. Litigation, use case law, and this is so brand new. We've only been at it since July of 2021. You got to set some boundaries up, and the only way to do that is to find the bad actors, set up some consent orders or some enforcement actions, and that will tell the industry what they can and cannot do. So we are on to transfer portal. We talked about NIL and the developments. Got the the interim policy of July 2021. Got the guidance in May of 2022. You've got the collective guidance in July of 2022. And we talked about the boosters and the collectives. And now we're going to jump into the transfer portal. On page 29, I like this quote from Mark Twain: "Never let school get in the way of an education." And that kind of applies to the transfer portal, where you got kids bouncing around the country in different schools. So the transfer portal, what is that? So the transfer portal allows student athletes a one-time transfer exception. So back in the day, student athletes, if they wanted to move to a different school, maybe the head coach left, maybe they weren't real happy, homesick, if they wanted to transfer, they would have to sit out for a full academic year. Not real fun if you get recruited by a coach and you move all the way across the country. A week later, that coach leaves, you've got a new staff, they change the offensive or the defensive scheme, and you no longer fit into what they're doing, you're kind of stuck. You want to leave too? You'd have to sit out a full academic year. So they finally, the NCAA did something pretty good for the student athletes and said, okay, look, we're going to give you a one-time exception. No questions asked, you move, and you can immediately practice, play games, and get financial aid at that new school, which is really cool. So we do have some amendments for the 22-23 school year, and these are impacts to the transfer portal window itself. We have some additional protections for the student athletes, and then we have some new stuff for post-grad. So they've finished up their academic stuff. They graduate in 3 years, but they still have athletic eligibility remaining. And they want to transfer, so new rules for them. And postgrads, the way to think about the NCAA is they give you 5 full years to play 4 years. So you get 5 years to play 4, but if a kid graduates in 3 years, they still have athletic eligibility remaining. They want to keep playing. This allows them to do that. So, page 31, here's how the one-time transfer criteria works. It's got to be a 4-4 school, not a 2-4 community college to 4-year. It's got to be 4-4. The student athlete must be academically eligible at both the current school and the new school. So if a kid goes on academic probation and they want to get the heck out because they just don't like the school, they may not qualify. So you have to be academically eligible at the current school, and you need to meet the requirements at the new school. So if you got a student athlete and they're not being realistic about kind of where they fit in, and they think, okay, I'm gonna transfer from a school that's not the toughest academics to a school that has the most rigorous academics in the country, they don't meet the new school's requirements, they throw themselves into the portal, that can create a lot of problems. So you got to do the due diligence ahead of time to make sure that you are eligible and wanted at some of these prospective schools before you jump in. So you can't have a prior transfer, but there are new waivers starting in 2022. And there has to be a written request by the student athlete to the current school's compliance department within the transfer portal window. And then importantly, the student athlete and the new head coach, if they do decide to transfer schools, the student athlete and the new head coach must certify that there was no direct or indirect communication prior to entering the transfer portal. So you got to wait until you're in the portal and it's public information across the country to the coaches. Once that kid's in the portal, then the conversations can start with the coaches on possibly transferring. So this is what changed. We used to have a May 1st or July 1st deadline when you had to make that decision to go into the portal, and that was replaced this academic year with a 60-day transfer window for all the sports. So if you play a fall sport, you have two windows, a 45-day window plus a 15-day window at the end of the academic term. Winter sports, it's a solid 60-day window. And spring sports, it's two windows, 45-day window plus a 15-day window. So as an example, for fall sports with football, the first window, 45 days, that starts the day after the championship selections, the bowl games, plus 15 days at the end of the year. So for this year, the days will change a little bit, academic year by academic year. 45 Days starts on December 5th, 2022 and runs through January 18th, 2023. That's 45 days. You got to make your decision if you want to go into the portal. Plus 15 days at the end of the year, May 1st through May 15th. So you got a couple of different time schedules there to make your decision, which means, you know, we got to be talking to these families and student athletes and do your due diligence. Do you qualify academically? Are you really wanted out there on the open market? You put yourself in the window, you got bad grades, nobody wants you to transfer, and now you're stuck at your current school and they may not want you either. That's going to be a tough spot for that kid. So this is a press release that came out on August 31st, 2022. So some really good protections from the NCAA for the student athlete. If the student athlete does transfer from school A to school B, school B is required to offer athletic financial aid through graduation. So the kid can't transfer from school A to school B. School B says, yeah, let's use this kid up for a year and we'll bring in somebody else. They got to be offering financial aid through graduation. They got to make that commitment. Of course, if the kid wants to transfer again or go pro, then that would not be an issue. They also provided for new window extension. So it's going to be an extra 30 days to enter the transfer portal. So, you know, every sport, whatever season, you get a total of 60 days, but they're going to tack on an additional 30 days to decide on that window based on a head coach change or if your athletics aid is reduced or canceled. So, you know, you have a good freshman season, head coach bolts for a new school, then you get a total of 60 days standard plus an additional 30 days to make your decision. So use that time. Don't be playing video games, watching Netflix. They got to be looking around and seeing if they're marketable at any other schools. So new waivers. I'm guessing this one is going to be really tricky. There's new waivers that allow for multiple transfers with no penalty. So they're basing this on a student athlete's well-being, their mental health, or if there are circumstances outside a student athlete's control. Now, this is really good that they're taking efforts to look out for student athletes' mental health. This will be very good for the student athletes who use it the correct way. But when you open up when you open it up to something this subjective, if a student athlete has transferred once at the second school, they hate the coach, they hate their teammates, and they want to move again, they will use this as a way to get out of school B and try to transfer to school C and get that waiver. If it's based on mental health, if it's based on circumstances outside the control, it will be abused. But again, it's overall, you got to take the good with the bad. This is a good development for student athletes, because if a student athlete moves from school A to school B, and then while they're at school B, let's say they have a family member back home and gets sick, that would be a circumstance outside the student athlete's control, possibly, or that could impact the student athlete's mental health, definitely. So what they're saying is, if you have something like that happen, then we're going to allow you to get that multiple transfer and not have to sit out an academic year. So that's really good. Down there at the bottom on page 33, we have in red, this one will come up again, but the NCAA rejected proposals to allow multiple transfers. This will be revisited. The NCAA wants to check and see how this one-time transfer rule impacts graduation rates. And if there's no adverse impact, they might revisit this. But as of today, student athlete gets a one-time transfer, no questions asked. They can practice, they can play, they can get financial aid immediately upon that transfer. But they're not allowed multiple transfers unless one of these waivers applies. But they will revisit the multiple transfer. Now, the single transfer is going to be really tough on college coaches as it is, because they're out on the recruiting trail trying to get high school athletes. And with the new one-time transfer, that requires college coaches to basically re-recruit his or her top players every year. Because if you have a student athlete and they have a lot of name, image, likeness opportunities, possibly in a different part of the country, they may take that. So you've got the coaches who are going to be spending a lot of time. I don't know how they're going to do this, but they're going to be spending a lot of time looking at how to re-recruit their same player. So it's going to be tough. So, page 34, this is what they said about post-grads. We had a change with how they handled post-grads and eligibility for the transfer portal. Postgraduates with athletic eligibility, and again, keep in mind that's the student-athlete. She graduates in 3 years. She wants to continue playing, and she wants to transfer. She would be exempt from the 60-day transfer portal window, and the reason they came up with that is that graduate programs have different and more detailed program application processes. So because of that complicated program application process for grad students, they said, we're not going to put you in the window. All you have to do is meet the transfer portal deadline. If you play a fall or winter sports, get into the portal by May 1st, and if it's a spring sport, by July 1st. So that's kind of a good development for them. Again, they're looking at ways to make things workable for student athletes, which is a good sign from the NCAA. So let's do a little bit of Q&A on page 35. What do we got here? Student athlete has already transferred once and wants to transfer again. Can they do that? If they transferred once, school A to school B, and now they want to transfer to school C, they got to sit out one academic year unless their sport was discontinued or they meet one of the waivers for mental health or circumstances outside the control. Again, that's a good rule, but let's be honest, that will be abused by some of the bad actors out there who just want to transfer and keep transferring. How to confirm academic eligibility. Student athlete has to reach out to his or her current compliance administration before entering the transfer portal, and that's so important, especially if you got a student athlete who's a hothead and they're angry at everybody at their school, they want to leave. You got to make sure they're working with their compliance department. You know, what do their academics look like? Are they meeting grades? Are they taking all the credits they need to? Are they really marketable out there before they enter the transfer portal? And you got to make sure that kids going to meet the new academic requirements too if they're moving to a school with more rigorous standards. Page 36 is a student athlete in the transfer portal automatically eligible for the new school? Nope. Student athlete enters the transfer portal, and that simply allows communication by the student athlete and the prospective school's athletic program. So that just puts them out there. Their information gets put into the portal, and everyone sees that they're available and looking to transfer schools. That's all it does. So what results, if any, in permissible communication between the student athlete and the coaches? You cannot have any direct or indirect communication between the student athlete and coaches at different schools until the student athlete is in the portal. If you've got a kid on scholarship or they're playing at school A, you can't have coaches tampering in that. It's kind of like it's tortious interference with the contract. You got a student athlete at school A, happy as can be. You can't have coaches reaching out and saying, hey, let's think about you getting moving over here. You can't have boosters reaching out and saying, hey, if you come over to school B, we're going to get you a $100,000 deal with a coffee shop down the road. And so this also includes family and associates of the student athletes, which we talked about. And if the student athlete does anything outside of the transfer portal, it obviously puts the schools at risk for tampering, but it also could impact the student athlete's athletic eligibility. And there's a paper trail and everything. There's going to be text messages, emails, social media blasts. You just got to make sure that the student athletes make sure they are in the transfer portal before they're reaching out to the coach to talk about possible transfers. Page 37, does the one-time transfer apply to all sports? Yes, it does. Doesn't matter if you play on the Alabama football team or if you're on the swim team at Stanford, it applies every sport across the country. Can the current school object to the transfer? So the kids at school A, and they put a bunch of time and money into the student athlete, room and board, tuition, health insurance, coaching, mentoring, tutors, they're putting all this stuff into it, and the kid says, I want to leave. Can school A object to the kid moving from school A to school B? Not anymore. There used to be what's called a written support requirement, and that was removed recently. So at this point, It's student athlete friendly. The current school and the new school, they must cooperate on the stuff when it comes to the transfer portal, looking at the academics and looking at the things that are necessary before the kid tries to transfer. So the current school, luckily, fortunately now, cannot object to that kid trying to move schools. Does the one-time transfer apply to student athletes transferring from a two-year school? Nope. It's got to be a 4-to-4 deal. There's like a 2-to-2 deal, but it's just the community college to 4 years. This transfer portal rule does not apply to that. We're thinking more of kids playing at Alabama and wants to move to Stanford. This is the stuff that's going to apply with the one-time transfer rule. So who on page 38, who is allowed to enter the student athlete into the transfer portal? It can't be the student athlete sitting at the library Friday night, bored, and they think, yeah, I'm gonna go into the transfer portal and see what happens. Nope, it's a lot more formal than that. And this is a big decision, which we'll talk about on the next page. The only person that can enter the student athlete into the transfer portal is the current school's compliance department. And once the student athlete notifies the compliance department, for D1, Division I, they have 2 business days to enter that information into the portal so it's available nationwide for other coaches to look at. And for personal information protection, there's just a limited amount of information that's going to be there. Now, trust me, the coaches, they have full-time staff scouring the transfer portal to see who's in, who's out. But the only thing that's going to be entered is the student athlete's ID, the school that they play for, the sport, and their email. And that's about it. It's not going to be a resume. It's not going to be highlight films. It's just bare bones information. And it's up to the schools across the country to be tracking this kind of stuff. But what they don't want to be doing, which you talked about, you want to be tracking this at the school, but you don't want to be tipping off the boosters about who you're trying to recruit, because then you get into tampering. All right, so when can communication start with prospective coaches? Only after the student-athlete appears in the transfer portal. So the student-athlete notifies compliance at the current school. Current school has 2 business days to enter that into the portal. Once it's entered in the portal, the student-athlete gets an email and says you're good to go. Then the conversations can start between the student-athlete and prospective coaches. So what is allowed before the transfer notice? So the transfer portal window isn't open yet. Can the student athlete do anything for him or herself to kind of get the ball rolling? Yes, they can if it's not athletics related. So the transfer window it's not open yet for the student athlete. They can still start communication with the new school's financial administration, registrar, and admissions, trying to check out different academic programs. They can also, this is where it gets tricky, and again, probably some bad actors out there, we know that. The student-athlete can also have contact with other student-athletes at the prospective universities, that's fine, but that contact cannot be at the coach's request. So student at the University A can contact student-athletes at School B, so long as the coach didn't reach out to the athletes at School B and say, hey, get in touch with Jimmy over there from School A. He just went into the portal. Tell him about how good things are out here and how we're going to hook him up with a good endorsement deal. He can't be doing that. It's okay to have contact with other student athletes trying to check out the program, but they can't be coached up by the coach at School B. Page 39. This is no joke. If you go into the portal. I'm going to take a sip of water here. Just bear with me for one sec. So this is no joke. And these are, we're talking about 18 to 22 year olds. They can be impulsive. They can be angry. They can make rash decisions. You really want to have conversations with the families if you're dealing with them and this issue. Once a student athlete contacts their current compliance department and they get entered into the transfer portal. So they haven't transferred yet. They've just said, I want to go into the transfer portal and explore my options. Once that athlete is entered into the transfer portal, at the current school they play at, they can have their playing time reduced. They can have their athletics aid reduced or completely canceled for future academic terms. and they can also lose a roster spot because the coach at the athletic department is going to be saying, hey, you don't like it here? You want to enter the portal and nobody's interested in you? You don't have the academics? You don't have the athletic skill set to transfer? Well, that's fine, but that's not our problem. If you don't want to be here, we're done. We're going to cut your playing time and or we're going to cut your athletic fade for few.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is SAT. S-A-T. All lowercase. SAT. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is SAT. S-A-T. All lowercase. SAT. Please take a moment and write this down.
Future terms, or we might just say we don't need you on the team. So you got to really think this through and have a good team around that student athlete before they make that decision to go into the portal, because once they do that, it can really get blacklisted at the school that they're at. We'll do a quick little transfer portal case study on page 40, and hopefully everybody saw Point Break with Keanu Reeves. And Patrick Swayze. Point Break was a cinematic treasure, and it's just one to see. It is a cinematic treasure. There's no doubt. So Johnny Utah, Keanu Reeves. So Johnny Utah attends Ohio State and plays quarterback. He is a freshman, shows up at Ohio State. He practices with the team in the summer, but Ohio State's Johnny Utah, you're too weird. We don't like you, Johnny. So they cut Johnny in the summer. So Johnny practices with the team. He's cut before the first game. Johnny's not happy. Johnny wants out. Johnny wants to go back to California. So he plays in the summer, cut before the first game. At the end of the academic year, between May 1st and May 15th, Johnny wants to transfer to UCLA, play football. Maybe he'll get some contacts and do an internship with the FBI or the police department out there. Who knows? So Johnny wants to transfer to UCLA and play football, but he never played a game at Ohio State. Does Johnny need to comply with the notice of transfer rules in the windows? Yes, he does, because Johnny went out to Ohio State. He practiced with the team. Even though he was cut before the first game, he was still a student athlete, so he still has to comply with the notice of transfer and the window. So he didn't play a game, but if he wants to transfer, he can do it. Got to do it during the window, and that's going to use up his one-time transfer if he gets that done. All right, so we're going to do a little bit of roundup here and what's next. And page 41, Patches O'Houlihan, this is another almost a cinematic treasure. And he says, if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball. And that's pretty much what we're dealing with name, image, likeness for the next 3 to 5 years. It's going to be dodgy. There's going to be a lot of unintended things that come up along the way. So we'll see how it goes. So page 42. This is what you got to do if you're involved. And again, you don't have to be a sports law attorney. It may impact you if you do any kind of corporate law or family law. You've got the family with a kid that's going to go to college or play soccer, and they're saying, "Hey, we've heard about this nil. We want to make sure we don't get in trouble." You got to pay attention to the NCAA. You got to pay attention to the state legislature for the states that you work in. You want to look at federal updates. Again, they have, I don't know, 7 or 8, 10 different proposals out there, but they all stalled out, but it may come back. It may come back tomorrow. It may come back in 5 years. Who knows? You got to pay attention to the schools, the conferences. They have their own set of rules and regulations. You got to be looking at what coaches are saying. Got to be looking at what boosters are doing and what agents and boosters. This is going to be a problem because it's such an attractive area to get into, and it's new, and everybody wants to be first. And so there's going to be a lot of bad behavior as we go along here over the next couple of years. So at the bare minimum, if you want to be up to date, you got to bookmark the NCAA news updates. So it's at ncaa.org/sports. So get that one down. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of litigation that's going to come up, because schools are trying to outdo each other, states are trying to outdo each other, and it all comes down to recruiting. So there are, I don't know the current status of this case here, but I put one down here on page 42 in regarding college athletic NIL out in California. And they were taking it one step further. They said it's not good enough to offer NIL deals to student athletes. They wanted to get rid of pay-for-play and recruiting as violations with NIL deals. They wanted to say, these are adults. These are 18 to 22-year-old adults, and if a school wants to pay them, if a booster wants to pay them, whatever it takes, we want to get this done so they can make the maximum amount of money that they want. And so they wanted to get rid of pay-for-play and recruiting. So we should probably expect to see that kind of stuff coming up a little bit more as we go along. This is stuff to keep in mind. Place your bets for the next 3 to 5 years. There's going to be unintended consequences. There's going to be a lot of black swans, things we just didn't think about. And I've highlighted a few of these. Place your bets on jail time. This is new industry. That's sad to say it, but somebody's got to go to jail before things get fixed, because you're going to have some bad actors with the agents and the boosters and that kind of thing. We've seen it in the past, but with this, you think about the pro leagues. There's a very limited number of athletes. You know, the NBA has a couple hundred, few hundred. NFL has, I don't know, 1,600 players, something like that. But for college, you've got 500,000 student athletes. That's the pool. And so there's going to be a lot of people reaching out there trying to get deals with those kids. And you're going to have a lot of people making bad decisions along the way so they can get a foothold. So jail time, enforcement actions, expect that to happen. Unionization and revenue share. This has been floated around, and it's going to come up every once in a while. We'll see how it develops. But will student athletes be able to unionize? Can they be involved in revenue sharing with the universities? We'll see. Name, image, likeness, pay to play, and recruiting. We'll see how that develops with some of these suits that are going on. Other important one is going to be endorsement deals plus the transfer portal. How does that impact student athletes? What about multiple transfers? If it goes to multiple transfers, pretty much all bets are off. I mean, these kids are going to be mercenaries between moving around schools for the best NIL deals that they can find. Education. Hopefully universities take this seriously, because taxes are going to become an issue if you have a student who resides in state E, state A, they play in state B, and they're doing endorsement deals when they go on road trips across eight different states. Are they up to date and educated on how to keep that money? If you're an independent contractor, you get paid gross, and you got to budget some money for taxes at the end of the year. So it's going to come down to budgeting, reporting, and so far there has been some student athletes that have gotten into not a jam, but they just weren't real clear on how to keep track of taxes. So that is going to become an issue, especially when you're talking about 18 to 22-year-olds. They get that gross check, and they're spending it pretty quickly. Contracts. Are the kids being educated on contracts? What are the agency fees? Do they know it's a good fee for a marketing agent? Some are, 20% might be in the high end, but apparently some of these, kind of shady agents, marketing agents, are trying to set fees at 40%. If you're 18 to 22, you probably don't know what's a reasonable fair market value for what's paying agent. NIL, what are they signing away? Are they signing away NIL for one year, 2 years, in perpetuity? Does a student athlete know what in perpetuity means, permanent? What about exclusivity? Can they only work with this tennis shoe and not other tennis shoes? Can they only do things in this state but not other states? And what categories? If they assign NIL, what categories and products does it involve? So they got to make sure these kids are educated on the taxes. And contracts, collectives, direction and control, we'll see how that develops. This is brand new. Locker room impact, that's one of those sneaky ones. If you've got a kid with 20 different endorsement deals and he's showing up late for practice every day, making excuses for why he doesn't understand the game plan because he is doing endorsement deals, that's going to be an impact that we just haven't seen previously, because NIL is only 15 months old. Grades and graduation impact. Already we talked about student athlete in season. It's a 65-hour work week between school, study hall, and practices and games. So if that's a 65-hour work week, and now you've got student athletes trying to make as much money as they can with endorsement deals, you pack on that amount of time, and that's going to really have some impact on the grades graduation for some athletes. In-season commitments, coaches don't want to see that, but student athletes might want to take advantage of in-season commitments because that's when they're hot, right? If you're playing football, you want to get your name out there during the football season when you're on ESPN. And what happens if you have a road game and you got a commitment out there? It's a lot of unintended things that we just haven't thought about. The other one down at the bottom on page 43, which might be kind of fun to watch, is state shopping for parents of high school athletes. If you know, during the pandemic, everybody's used to working remote, and if mom and dad makes $85,000 a year, but their student athlete, she has a huge social media following. If she can make $150K a year in endorsement deals, why not move to a state, work remote, where that student athlete can get paid for name, image, likeness? So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. Page 44, got a few sports law and business podcasts where you might want to check these out if you are interested in this field. Game Changer is really good. That focuses on NCAA, NIL, and the transfer portal. The Business of Sports, that's more pro sports, but it kind of tracks NCAA issues as well. And then also, if you're a sports parent and you got kids coming up, Youth Inc., which is from Greg Olson. He used to play tight end for the Carolina Panthers. He's got a really good podcast, and he interviews, sports psychologists and people like that that are involved in student-athlete development. All right, we are a little over 1 hour, so I really appreciate your time for hanging out. I love the topic, and I've got my contact information on page 45. Feel free to reach out. Any questions, comments, I'm available, and hope everybody has a great holiday season coming up. Take care.